This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
These are not just the oil companies. This is what's under the ground in America. And in some ways, we deserve to have some say in how that stuff is taken out of the ground, when it's taken out of the ground, when it's sold, how much is sold, how much gets burned. I mean, to a certain degree, that's what governments are supposed to do.
In the words of the late U.S. Senator Everett Dirksen, the oil can is mightier than the sword. Whether it's mightier than the COVID-19 virus remains to be seen, however. This week on Sea Change Radio, we welcome back energy expert Daniel Dicker to talk about his new book, Turning Oil Green. Dicker views oil companies and oil-rich countries like Saudi Arabia through an unexpectedly nuanced and sanguine lens as we discuss the role they may play in our energy future. We also delve into the current state of the fracking industry in the U.S. and how the global pandemic has affected the fossil fuel industry. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Daniel Dicker. He is an energy expert, and his new book is called Turning Oil Green. Dan, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
Alex, it's really, I want to start by saying it's so great to be on your show again. I really respect what you do there.
Thanks. We often touch upon lots of my inane questions about oil when we speak, but we could be a little more focused today because you have a new book coming out where you've had to put a lot of thought and organization into laying out your case for a market-based path to renewables, which is the subtitle of Turning Oil Green. What do you mean by turning oil green first?
Well, you know, the idea is, what I've seen over the course of the last 10 years has been a difficulty in significantly moving the portfolio of energy in terms of renewables forward. And most of that is because, in my view, is that the oil companies have stepped on themselves over the course of the last 10 years, and oil prices have been very, very low. And because oil prices have been very, very low, renewables have been not as competitive as they should have been. So oil prices naturally should go up over time. I mean, it's like just about everything else, every other asset class that's out there. And for several reasons, which I lay out in the book, oil hasn't done that. So my thesis is to, first of all, understand why oil prices have stayed low for a long time, period of time, and then to suggest some quality kind of changes that can be done now in a bipartisan country. I mean, in a politically partisan country that both sides should be able to agree on. That'll significantly alter the amount of renewable energy that we're putting in, you know, that we're using in terms of our entire energy portfolio, which right now it's pitiful. It's just a pitiful amount.
You believe that these enormous oil companies are not going to just be gutted. They're going to be able to pivot and lead us or help lead us into a clean energy tomorrow. What are some of the signs that you see that oil companies are ready to help instead of just continue to boost their own profits?
Well, first of all, a number of them, and this has started with the European oil companies particularly, but it's moved to the American oil companies. A lot of them have abandoned many of the long-term oil lobbying organizations that have been climate change deniers, you know, historically climate change deniers. They've continued and now are really increasing the amount of money, of R&D money, that they put in for renewables. Now, most of the Europeans are up to 15% of their CapEx, which is an enormous amount comparative to what they've done in the past. And, finally, you find the shareholders themselves of oil companies really demanding a more responsive attitude of oil companies towards the renewable tsunami that's obviously upon us. So in all ways, the oil companies have to be responsive, have begun to be responsive, continue to be responsive. And one of the things that I say in the book is that it's the worst kind of mistake to stand on the outside and try and punish oil companies, because there's a lot of advantages to letting them participate and actually be a major influence forward towards the renewable future that we need.
Yes, I read an article about Shell, Royal Dutch Shell, for the first time since World War II, cut its dividend, and it's cutting back its workforce over the next few years. I think they're shaving 9,000 jobs. But Ben van Beurden, the CEO, has a quote in here that I wanted you to translate for me, because I think it fits into what we're talking about. Van Beurden said, "Shell had to be a simpler, more streamlined, more competitive organization that's more nimble and able to respond to customers." And he reiterated that Shell intended to become a net zero emissions energy business by 2050 or sooner. Quote, "We will have some oil and gas in the mix of energy we sell by 2050, but it will be predominantly low carbon electricity, low carbon biofuels, it will be hydrogen, and it will be all sorts of other solutions too," he said. So fit that quote into your basic thesis that these oil companies will be looking elsewhere beyond oil.
So first of all, Shell is not the first to commit to what they call net zero carbon output in the future. BP was the first to commit to that, and Shell is second. Like I say, the Europeans are the ones who are sort of leading the way, but the Americans are not very far behind on this. And what I've always said is that the in terms of energy infrastructure, that is, taking it from wherever it's made, finding a way to distribute it and ultimately sell it, get it to consumers' hands. This is the network is entirely owned by energy companies. And there is no way that you are going to get to a carbon neutral future without employing this infrastructure that's already in place. And the energy companies own that, and they know how to operate it, and they know how it works. Plus, they're not stupid. They understand, as I lay out in the book, that there's a sort of natural progression of energy. And we've come from, wood and burning horse manure to coal to fossil fuels to a sort of transition to natural gas. And now several renewables are starting to move in as well. And they're not, ignorant of this natural progression of energy. And they know what the future holds, and they're preparing for it and have been for decades. And like I've said, to you just before, they've taken honest steps in terms of real money in preparing for that and making sure that they're going to be part of that future.
Yes, it's probably an awkward analogy, but if you looked at what Philip Morris did in the 80s, they transitioned basically from being a company that was producing something that was a fading product in tobacco, and they transitioned into becoming one of the largest food companies in the world, if not the largest, by buying Kraft in 1988, and I think they also bought General Foods. I mean, I remember reading it when I was in college, just thinking, oh, now Philip Morris is a food company. But if you think about it, the distribution, so many intricacies of the tobacco business are probably quite similar to the food business.
And what's interesting about that, if you really look deeply in that, they're doing that without abandoning cigarettes. They don't completely abandon cigarettes, just like oil companies don't abandon fossil fuels as they move to extend themselves into renewables. And that's in a lot of ways, much of the infrastructure, as you say, for both, like with Philip Morris, with food and tobacco, is the same and can be used. And so, there is an advantage of oil companies being a part of the increase of offered renewables, as opposed to just trying to get someone from out of the blue who doesn't have the kind of experience and the kind of, like I say, established infrastructure already in place.
Yes, you write in the book, What if instead of seeing oil and oil companies as the enemy, we could actually incentivize oil companies to integrate cleaner natural gas and ultimately carbon zero energy sources such as wind and solar into their supply portfolios? So talk about incentivizing these oil companies from a policy standpoint. A lot of people don't really want to see any more incentives or bones thrown the oil companies' way. They want to see them punished for their years of abuse of the environment.
And I understand that. But I argue very, very strongly that this is the wrong attitude to have. There are so many advantages to making them a part of this. It helps accelerate what we're trying to do if we make them a part of this. And they want to be a part of this. And to just punish them for that, for the sake of punishment for being fossil fuel sellers for so many decades, it goes with our instincts, but against what we're ultimately trying to achieve. So a couple of things that I've first of all, there's a huge section of the book in trying to drive the relative costs of renewables down compared to fossil fuels. And the main way that I suggest doing that is finding some market-based solutions in driving oil prices up, because the first thing that I notice in the first chapter is that the relative costs of renewables, while they have dropped significantly over the last 10 years, are sort of reaching their limits in terms of how much cheaper they can get. So your other choice besides making renewables cheaper, if you want to, you know, make them more competitive on a comparative basis, is by making fossil fuels more expensive. And I spent a long time going through that. Some of the policy answers that I try to suggest include removing, for example, the subsidies. There's $5 billion still out there for U.S. oil companies for fossil fuels, but removing them completely, but giving them back to the fossil fuel companies, provided they can prove they'll use that money to develop renewable sources. That, to me, is a shift of money and that allows the oil companies to pivot without losing anything. And that's a win-win kind of suggestion that I have. That's one of them anyway. Gas on the hillside, oil in the teacup, watch all the chorus of life lose their joy. Distortion becomes somehow
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Daniel Dicker. He's an energy expert, and his new book is called Turning Oil Green. So, Dan, you have a really interesting chapter about Saudi Arabia in your book, and I read by Matthew Simmons, Twilight in the Desert, over a decade ago that really interested me, and he kind of posited that Saudi Arabian oil had peaked and that the end of easy oil for the Saudis was over, but they had the technology to keep being an important force in the market. You obviously are not a big fan of a lot of what happens in modern day Saudi Arabia in terms of religious and cultural oppression, but let me read this quote to you and then you can kind of expand on it. I certainly don't condone the culture of repressive society of modern day Saudi Arabia. However, in the energy sphere, where we are primarily concerned, they have been far more of a victim of both U.S. government pressures and U.S. oil producers' behavior than an aggressor. Can you expand on that?
Well, yeah, and part of it, first of all, you got to remember that the political attitude towards Saudi Arabia in this country is completely negative. But in many ways, Saudi Arabia outside of Israel in reality remains one of the best allies that the United States has outside of Israel, of the Arab states. There's no one who's been quite as reliable as the Saudis. They have, of course, only one goal in mind because their entire economy is based on oil, and that's obviously to see as high a price of oil as they can. In terms of the thesis of my book, that's kind of what we want. We want to see oil prices get very, very high in order to push the renewable future forward more smartly. And in this, the Saudis have always had a problem with U.S. governments because most U.S. presidents view high oil prices as a political negative for obvious reasons, but none viewed it as much as a political negative as Donald Trump. And he's done everything he can to squash oil prices in the time that he's been in office. And that's well before the pandemic squashed them, completely, without his help.
What was the political motivation for him to squash oil prices? Just to say that gas is cheap to voters?
Yes. I mean, this is, we talked before we went on air, and we talked about Donald Trump and his kind of childish reactions in the first debate. He's a very small brain kind of thinker politically, and that's not very sophisticated ideas going. But you can see in the tweets and the interviews he's had, even well before he became president, that he very much equates low energy prices with success, political success. And he came into office, and one of the major goals he had, and one of the reasons he got Rex Tillerson as the Secretary of State and all these other oil guys as part of his first cabinet anyway, was to try and have that kind of influence over oil pricing, because he really believes that that is a key to winning elections. Now, other things have gotten in the way since then, so you can't see it now, but there is just a huge history of tweets and actions over the course of the first 2 years, at least, of his presidency, where he tried very, very hard to make sure that oil prices didn't get anywhere above, $60 or $70 a barrel. And he succeeded.
And we've talked before where you've laid out one solution being for us to really make a significant shift and make a clean break from fossil fuels. You think oil needs to be in the over $200 a barrel area, and right now it's around $40 a barrel.
The best guess that I have in my calculations is that solar energy or wind energy runs at about an equivalent of $26-$27 a barrel. And as oil stands, in the mid-30s or low-40s, it's just not competitive enough to take over some of the already established infrastructure, for gasoline and natural gas and all of that.
And it's hard to do an apples to apples comparison when you consider all the externalities of fossil fuels, like what we're seeing with climate change, right?
And the externalities of renewables, which is always overlooked. It's as if there's never any maintenance when it comes to renewables, when there's actually quite a lot. There's actually quite a lot of climate or carbon problems with some of the rare earth mining that has to go into a lot of these renewable technologies. So again, there's a lot of stuff that doesn't get discussed. Things get very simplified when you get deep in the weeds, or you try and get out of the weeds. But I try to make it as simple as possible. The point being that what I'd like to see is I'd like to see oil at least 4 times as expensive as solar. So yeah, I'm looking for $120-$125, and sustainably there, so that energy companies know that they'll have a certain amount of profitability on far less volume of oil that they're going to be able to sell, because as we move renewables along, it's going to take up more of the portfolio of demand. And you have to incentivize the oil companies by, ensuring or trying to give them confidence that the amount of oil they sell, even though it's going to be greatly reduced, is going to yield them as much, or if not more, than of the profitability than they have with oil sitting here in the doldrums at $40.
So why don't you break down for us the coronavirus and how it affects oil prices. Maybe summarize those last couple chapters for us if you can.
Well, of course, the virus destroyed global demand of oil, so that no amount of cuts from OPEC or other, you know, dropping of rigs or you know, lack of production from smaller producers or even larger producers could overcome the amount of demand that was instantaneously lost. Some imagined that at least in the first couple of months of the pandemic, as much as 25 to 30 million barrels a day of demand was lost. And even now, you know, it's hard to gauge how much of that demand will come back and how quickly and so forth. So that's why you see oil prices that sit, you know, $35-$40 a barrel and seem to be staying there no matter what else goes on. And for oil analysts, they're mostly expecting them not to recover so quickly, because the double-edged sword of this is not only has demand dropped, but those who have been producing have continued to produce and added again an enormous glut of oil that has been going into storage and other places for the past, you know, 7-8 months. And so that is also going to be an overhang of oil that needs to be cleared before prices can begin to recover. So the first answer to your question is how are analysts looking at this? Nothing gets really good at the very least until the second quarter of 21 and probably the third or fourth quarter of 21, when oil prices can even begin under a best case scenario to get constructive again.
This is Alex Wise on SeaChange Radio, and I'm speaking to energy expert Daniel Dicker. His new book is called Turning Oil Green. So, Dan, let's turn to something that we've addressed a lot in our conversations over the years, and that's natural gas and domestic oil production in the U.S. How has the coronavirus outbreak affected that and concomitantly global decrease in demand for oil? How is the fracking industry shaping up, irrespective of who becomes the next president?
You know, Alex, the last book I wrote in 2015 talked about the ultimate demise of many of, and the needed ultimate demise of many fracking companies because of an oil bust that happened in 2014. That didn't happen. And the reason that didn't happen is because the banks and the U.S. government put out, you know, an enormous helicopter of money to keep these guys alive through every kind of bad market condition possible. And so what I would say to you is that what the coronavirus has done, it has, you know, whatever was out there, whether it's oil or anything else, that was corrupt prior to going into the virus made very clear how corrupt it was. And in this way, you know, the coronavirus has been like a blinding spotlight on the fracking business to show just how insanely badly managed and over-leveraged they were and poorly run, and how much they had taken advantage of you know, low interest rates and easy capital from both the Wall Street and the U.S. government. So this sounds like Trump taxes, right? And basically, you know, this is what we're seeing right now. We're seeing a lot of these companies who are finally getting their comeuppance and very quickly, based on an absolutely decimated supply chain globally. So in many ways, the thesis that I'd worked on in 2015 has only come to fruition after seeing, you know, the effects of the pandemic on the industry.
When I read your chapter on natural gas, I kept seeing the need for oversight and regulation. And one of the talking points from the Republicans is that regulation of the natural gas industry, or any industry for that matter, would just cripple them. How much of the natural gas industry in the US right now is their success predicated on doing things the wrong way, cutting corners and flaring and venting and not worrying about polluting people's water supply, etc.
Look, the U.S. oil and gas industry for fracking is based in three or four states: the Dakotas, Texas, Oklahoma. You know, this is where much of the industry is kind of set up. And in these states that are oil rich, there's been nothing but a free-for-all in terms of regulation, as in none, and in capital and the ability to get it, which is a lot. And all of this freedom in terms of capital and lack of regulation has managed to destroy the industry. We've got bankrupting companies by the hundreds. We've got enormous job losses where we had enormous job gains during the early part of the aughts. And in all ways, it would seem to say, well, maybe there's another way to work this out. What I'm saying is that the oil companies have sort of proven that they are incapable of resisting the temptations of oil without someone stepping in and taking a certain amount of control over, by the way, what is our natural resources. These are ours. These are not just the oil companies. This is what's under the ground in America. And in some ways, we deserve to have some say in how that stuff is taken out of the ground, when it's taken out of the ground, when it's sold, how much is sold, how much gets burned. I mean, to a certain degree, that's what governments are supposed to do. And in this particular case, as I have said for a long, long time, the energy companies, and particularly the independents, shale companies, have proven they are entirely incapable of respecting this responsibility.
Well, it's terrific work. It's called Turning Oil Green, A Market-Based Path to Renewables. Dan Dicker, thanks so much for being my guest on SeaChange Radio.
Thank you, Alex.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Samford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Stanton Moore, The Who, and Steely Dan. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.